Welcome to Legal Talk, a monthly conversation about the American legal system with Minnesota Supreme Court Associate Justice Gordon Moore. Well, good morning. We are a little bit delayed, but we are here nonetheless. Good morning, Gordon. How are you? Good
morning, Rich, and my apologies for the delay. It's dangerous when you're doing show prep 15 minutes before airtime, but we're all good. We're here safely and sound.
Exactly, exactly. As I promised last month when we talked, we have an intro, we have an outro also for this show.
Nice, very
that
nice.
We'll play when we're done.
I'm looking forward to that, actually.
I'm way too proud of that intro. I'm sorry. Thank you for coming to the KYMN Christmas party the other night and classing the joint up a little bit.
Well, I don't know about that. My wife did, for sure. But it was just fantastic to meet some of the folks who I've enjoyed listening to so much over the last two and a half years since Jane and I moved back to Northfield. And it was a blast. It was a lot of fun. I agree with everything you said earlier about the hospitality at the Armory.
Right.
It's just Liz and Jonathan just do a great job. And Jeff was very kind to make us part of his guest list, and it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was just really fun to have you and Jane there. I had a chance to talk with Jane for a little bit. I really enjoyed that. Not that I didn't enjoy talking with you too, but yeah,
you know. Well, right, but you know, some people do like to talk about things other than, you know, history, sports, and legal issues.
Yeah, but we had a really good conversation about that Viking game.
So. Well, we did. It was what a weekend of sports.
My goodness.
I mean, you know, between the World Cup championship game on Sunday and then the, the Vikings game on Saturday, the 1,000th game.
Yeah.
And in that morning, I'd been thinking about how many of those games had I watched or listened to and wasn't feeling the greatest about that, wondering if that was the best use of my life or time. And then I hung with the Vikings on Saturday, despite my better instincts.
My goodness.
You know, my wife is like, you know, ye of little faith, got to keep listening. And my brother, season ticket holder for many years, actually left the game at halftime out of frustration with his family. And they were pulling into their driveway in Rochester as Dalvin Cook scored the tying touchdown.
Oh, my goodness.
And, I don't think it was a great moment in my brother's family. In fact, I think his text later to me was, this might have been the worst decision of my life. But it did look pretty bleak, objectively. But, you know.
I turned the game off. I turned the game off when it was 36-7 and went out to shovel my driveway. And as I was finishing it up, my phone started buzzing off the hook.
Right.
And my cousin had texted me and just said, wow. And I was like, wow, what? I mean, but at least I got to go in and watch overtime. So
I think the ESPN win percentage for the Colts at that point that you left the game, 36-7 was like 99.7% or something.
Well, you do the math, and no one had ever. I mean, it was the greatest comeback in history. No one had ever overcome that kind of a deficit.
Well, you think of everything that happened, and shockingly, overcoming two botched officials' calls on Viking touchdowns that were called back, defensive touchdowns, and we overcame that, made the defensive plays that we had to, you know, these third and short, fourth and short tackles.
Yep.
Any one of those is missed, game's different.
Exactly.
And it's just, you'll probably never see anything like that again.
frankly, as a Viking fan, I hope not. But anyway, this is a show about the legal system, not about the Vikings. So
We have to segue to that. Well, Rich, we've got our January cases coming up here for the Supreme Court, and it's a little lighter month for the Supreme Court. We had some rescheduling due to, I think, attorney conflicts, maybe some COVID issues. So we've only got 8 cases on the docket, 1 first-degree murder case, 1 tax court appeal, and then the other 6 are petitions for review from Court of Appeals decisions. A couple of cases that I thought might be of some interest to the listeners, State versus Barrow is coming to the court on Wednesday the 4th, and that involves a warrantless search of a worn shoulder purse that a person was wearing that was ordered out of a vehicle subject to a traffic stop. Under the automobile exception to the Constitution, if the police have probable cause to believe that evidence of a crime is going to be found within the interior of an automobile, generally that gives the police the ability to search containers contained inside the passenger part of the automobile.
Okay.
So the question is, this worn shoulder purse, the passenger brings it outside the vehicle, puts it on the top of the car, and the police say, hold it a second, we're going to search that. And the question is that lawful under the federal and state constitutions? And so that issue is coming to the court.
My goodness.
And it's kind of, it's you know, the case itself, it's a fifth-degree controlled substance crime. So in and of itself, I mean, that's a relatively low-level drug crime. Right. But, you know, the implications of the doctrine are pretty important to, you know, people who are riding in automobiles. Generally speaking, you do have a diminished expectation of privacy in a car just because of the fact that you're driving on a public roadway and you are, you know, subject to licensure to drive a vehicle on a public roadway. And there's some things like that, but still you don't forfeit your, you know, constitutional rights because you're in a car. And so as a passenger, you know, as a person that has a shoulder purse, what are your rights? And so I think there's going to be some interesting discussion about that.
That's a really interesting conversation because just the, I mean, you know, for as long as people have been driving, for as long as people have carried purses, one would think that this case might have already popped up by now.
It has in other jurisdictions.
Okay.
And in federal courts. And so I expect the lawyers will be talking about that. Now, there are variations on this theme that have occurred in Minnesota. And so if you listen to the oral arguments on the 4th, you'll hear a discussion of the automobile exception and the application of that. And so just as a reminder, the court's cases are live streamed on the day of argument through the mncourts.mincourts.gov website, and they are archived too, just like the podcasts on the radio station here are. The other case that I think could have kind of some interest to people, an estate case. We don't do a lot of estate cases, but on Thursday the 5th, we have the matter of the estate of Matthew Tomczyk, decedent. And the question there is whether the parents of the decedent's ex-wife or former wife are devisees under the will. In other words, the parents-in-law, do they inherit anything under this person's will after the a divorce has occurred.
Okay.
And so kind of an unusual intersection of family law and estate law there. And I think that will make for some interesting discussion. I think the estate lawyers, family lawyers and estate lawyers will be very interested in that. So we have one first-degree murder direct appeal. We had a bunch of them last term. That's State versus King. This sitting on the 5th of January. And some other civil matters, tax matters that are probably of less general interest. But I always think that just when you think a case isn't going to be interesting, then you hear some really excellent oral arguments. And it you know, reminds you of, wow, there's some really substantive issues here. So that's the January case docket. And I thought, Rich, maybe we could talk a little bit today about the upcoming legislative session and budgetary issues related to the justice system, because that's kind of an important issue to me.
Well, we were talking about this on Friday, and the first thing I said is I will follow you anywhere because I'm already pretty excited to be talking. I'm a geek that way. I'm already pretty excited to be talking about the new legislative session.
Yes.
It felt like there was a cliffhanger at the end of the last session.
Well, there was. Yeah. There was a supplemental budget request that was part of a large omnibus piece of legislation that would have addressed some public safety issues as well as funding issues, and it just it didn't go anywhere, frankly.
Right.
It just died.
Well, the whole thing. Most things kind of died at the end of that session.
Yeah, it was caught up in, I think, election year politics, and it just got put on the shelf.
Yep.
And so those same issues don't go away, though. They are back. Our budget for the 21-22 biennium for the judicial branch was just a little south of $770,000, $100,000.
I'm sorry. I don't mean to interrupt you, Justice Moore.
Yeah.
But the whole budget for the Minnesota legal system is less than $1 million.
It is not a large budget. I mean, we are a veritable drop in the bucket over, you know, the entire system. It's a small piece of the whole pie.
That surprises the heck out of me, though, just because we're talking about a co-equal branch of government here. I mean, and okay, you might not, there might not be as many people working in that branch, but it is, there's a lot going on.
Well, my numbers may be a little off there, and I don't want anybody to quote me, but the bottom line is we have a relatively small piece of the whole state pie, and we came to the legislature for a supplemental budget request to help a variety of things, primarily focused on employee retention, particularly court system related employee retention, but also public defender and civil legal aid.
Yeah.
And, you know, we believe that the best way for us to work our way out of the pandemic, that the pandemic related budget problems that that we've had related to pandemic related caseload problems, I should say, is to fund the people that are working on those cases. And and we, you know, we can't do this by ourselves. The branch, the challenge related to the pandemic backlog was created because of just for a period of time, we just weren't able to really process cases.
Right.
We didn't know what we were doing, frankly.
Courts were shut down for the better part of a year.
Well,
on and off.
I mean, it was, we went, I'd say actually, Rich, probably about, you know, a month of that was a pure shutdown. We went to remote hearings awfully quickly. We translated to a remote platform pretty quickly. It was really pretty surprising how quickly that happened in the spring of 2020.
Okay.
But what couldn't happen were in-person cases until precautions were made to get things put together in a way that is, you know, safe for people. I mean, we couldn't bring jurors into courtrooms without, you know, assurances of safety. And remember, this was all pre-vaccine. This is all in the world of, you know, wiping down shopping bags with wipes and people just not knowing how COVID was being transmitted.
Double masking. And
And so plexiglass was installed in a lot of our courtrooms. So as a result of that, we have a backlog in the criminal case calendar. Now, that backlog has been diminishing, and the Judicial Council's backlog reduction plan was to reduce the pending major caseload, major criminal caseload, by 20% for every 4 months from November of 21 to June of 23. And so the hope was by, you know, next summer, basically, that that backlog would be eliminated. But what's happening, not only is there a backlog, but case filings are going up now. Part of the pandemic related effect on the court system was that case filings went down dramatically. And so we ended up now we're seeing it in most of our major districts with caseloads going back up. The eviction moratorium was lifted.
Yep.
Some of the things that led to those case filings going down. Mm-hmm. I mean, frankly, prosecutors weren't charging, you know, everything.
Right.
I mean, sheriffs didn't want people in jail unless they absolutely needed to be in jail because of COVID and liability issues. And so what's happened is the backlog from past cases is there, but we've got new work coming in. And so although the trends have been good, we need to continue meeting the Judicial Council's plan. And so in order to do that, we have to really redouble efforts to make sure that we're getting cases moved through the system.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, we can't do that alone. Mm-hmm. We are part of a system, and the system relies on its stakeholders.
Yeah.
And so particularly in this criminal area, our public defenders, our county attorneys and our city attorneys, probation officers, law enforcement. I mean, these are all parts of the justice system that need to work in sync in order to move these cases forward. And I can tell you from my experience that in you know, what I call greater Minnesota, you know, greater,
I mean,
it has been a challenge to continue to hire lawyers through a process that's gone on over the last couple of years as baby boomers have started to retire, pandemic issues have taken forward, and, you know, frankly, salaries for some of these positions just haven't kept up.
Here in Rice County, I want to say this is 2021, the courts were shut down for a while, and then they reopened. But then they had to shut down again in Rice County because all of our public defenders in the county had quit, and they couldn't hire anymore.
And that's Rice County. I mean, Rice County is, you know, 40 to 60 miles away from the Twin Cities area.
Yeah.
You go out to way out state where I came from, it is really a challenge to recruit new lawyers to come out there. Part of the challenge is geographic, but part of it is budget related. I mean, you know, salaries need mm-hmm. to be reasonable. Now, nobody goes into public service work, such as being a public defender or a civil legal aid lawyer, with the idea that they're going to be making the kind of money you'd make at a big law firm. Sure. I mean, that's just not part of that deal. You're going in there for different reasons. But you still have to pay the bills. You still have law school debt. You still have, you know, obligations to meet. And when salaries are not keeping pace with the private sector, it's a challenge. And it's not just the lawyers, Rich. The court staff, I mean, our branch has really struggled to retain and recruit people to work in the court system. Just our court clerks, our interpreters, court reporters, you know, these are all people that we rely on to move these cases forward. It doesn't just happen with a judge, you know, sitting in a black robe, you know, using a gavel. There's a lot that goes on behind the scenes, and the branch has streamlined and centralized a lot of the work that used to be done on paper. We have, you know, electric filing and electric, you know, we have people that can be, you could literally be sitting in an office in Northfield accepting filings for, you know, another judicial district electronically. I mean, those sorts of efficiencies have happened, but we still want to keep courthouses open. Mm-hmm. We still want to have staff there to answer questions, mm-hmm. to take emergency filings. And that's critical to access to justice. And frankly, when our districts are competing with private sector jobs, you know, in just to retain basic court staff, that is really tough.
And really, so what it gets down to is talking about we're funding basic constitutional rights.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I do want to emphasize that, Rich. You make a really good point here. This, you know, the access to justice for criminal and civil cases is, you know, is part of our constitutional obligations.
Yeah.
I mean, particularly in the criminal area. I mean, if you can't afford a lawyer, the government's got to provide you one.
We tell you that right up front, as a matter of fact.
And, you know, with an overtaxed justice system, you know, the amount of time that attorneys have to deal with any client's case is going to be dependent on that. And so the vital role that judges and employees have in ensuring access to justice just can't be understated. And, you know, this is a little bit self-serving because I'm obviously part of that system.
Sure, of course.
I'm being a bit of a cheerleader for that. I will plead guilty to that. But it's really important because we hear concerns about, you know, the public safety issue. We mm-hmm. hear valid questions raised about, you know, community safety, about, you know, is the justice system being responsive? Is it being fair? Is it being equitable? Is it doing the right thing? And an underfunded justice system is not going to help the community's public safety or anybody's sense of wherewithal, frankly.
That just shouldn't happen. It should be a higher priority than that.
Well, I don't think there's any significant disagreement of that.
Yeah.
And the hope is, you know, we do have reportedly some money on the table in St. Paul. And I know that there's going to be a lot of asks for that. And, you know, the legislators are going to have to make, you know, prudent decisions. You know, this isn't mm-hmm. just a Christmas wish list here, but we're talking about basic, you know, needs, you know, and I just want to emphasize that our branch over the past few years has done a lot to facilitate access to justice. I mean, these remote hearings have kept the courthouse doors open mm-hmm. and have actually, for a lot of people, made it easier to get to court for, you know, cases that maybe aren't as, you know, needy to have that in-person appearance. You know, if you could appear from work or something to handle your case instead of driving to the courthouse, that's an access to justice issue.
Yep.
We have developed a Minnesota Court Records online program. MCRO is the acronym, where you can now go to the MinCourt's website and you can, frankly, find out, you know, what you what you might want to find out about what's happening in the court system. And that's, again, about access and transparency. And so we've done these things despite, you know, the pandemic. The courthouse doors have been kept open. There were a few weeks where things were a little dicey in March of 20, if I remember. Mm-hmm. But, or, you know, we have continued to move forward. So we are hopefully going to see a response from the legislator to the request for, you know, budgetary needs. And I might just say the counties and cities fund prosecutors, they fund county and city attorneys, and they fund the police department. And, you know, that's a whole separate budget discussion. Most of those decisions were made in December. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's all part of the big picture here. The state funds certain things. Cities and counties are funded by other things. But it's all regarding public safety. And that's where I think we need to be focusing right now, because that's a key mission of government, is to provide for the public safety and provide for the civil resolution of legal disputes, not resorting to, you know, stuff going on in the streets to settle disputes, frankly.
Right.
I mean, we're trying to keep, you know, a civil legal society here. In order to do that, we've got to have the funding.
Well, and, you know, there's a $17.6 billion surplus sitting on the table, as you've alluded to, at the legislature right now. And yes, there are going to be a lot of people coming with their hands out, with a lot of asks. And I'm kind of stuck on this idea that we're spending less than $1 million on the state legal system. I have to believe there's money there that could go to helping out the legal system.
Yeah, and again, my numbers may be off there. We have a small section of the state budget, frankly, is the legal system. Rich, in the subsequent months, I'd like to segue to a discussion that was prompted by an article in the Star Tribune on Sunday about the juvenile justice system. And we don't have enough time today to get into the nitty-gritty of that.
Right,
but
right.
Over the next month or two, I'd really like to talk about the juvenile justice system, because the article in the Star Tribune on Sunday was really provocative. And it talks about what's viewed as a, you know, pipeline to prison for juveniles that exists, some people think, within our juvenile justice system right now.
Interesting.
It's a tough discussion. And, you know, I have to be careful, because we have cases that involve juveniles being certified to stand trial in adult court. And so, you know, I can't say anything about individual cases that could come before us. But the policy discussions are things that, you know, the legislature hopefully is going to be addressing at some point in time, because as part of the public safety concerns that exist, particularly in the big city, you know, a rise in juvenile crime is undoubtedly part of that. You know, the unfortunate reality is that, you know, people have seen aftermaths of carjackings and accidents related to that by, you know, we're talking 14, 15-year-olds that are stealing cars and frankly, hurting people and crashing vehicles and just causing chaos.
Yep.
Now, you know, not to over-dramatize that or catastrophize it, that's not my point. But I think there is a ongoing question of what is the best way to deal with serious criminal activity committed by juveniles. And I'm talking about, you know, I'm not talking about 17 and 18 year olds here. I'm talking about
14.
Yeah. Young. I mean, it's really, really a troubling trend.
Yeah.
And, you know, is our system adequate to deal with that? The paper discussed on Sunday, there's a hybrid between the juvenile justice system and the adult justice system called the extended juvenile jurisdiction system, which was adapted a number of years ago as a way to try to keep kids in the juvenile system, but hold over their heads, so to speak, adult consequences if they screwed up in the juvenile system.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happens, according to this article, is that kids that are in that, what we call EJJ system, if they violate probation, they could, you know, have their adult sentence executed, in other words, imposed. And so they would go into the adult, you know, incarceration system, which unfortunately doesn't a focus on rehabilitation. It's a whole different process than, you know, the juvenile justice system's focus is on rehabilitation.
Right.
And so when you put young kids into an adult prison system, you know, the outcomes are typically not good.
And you hear on a fairly regular basis that so-and-so is going to be tried as an adult for this. And that always sounds to me, I mean, you know, leaving out the level and the extremeness of the crime, right? It always sounds really ominous to me when you're talking about trying a 16-year-old as an adult. I mean, because I've seen a lot of movies and TV, it just feels like, well, you're just throwing that kid away now.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, and I think over the next couple months, I'd like to talk about the details of that to maybe demystify some of that. That would be great. Why do juveniles find their way into the adult court system?
Yeah.
Why and how? There's a specific set of laws that govern that and court procedures. It isn't just some arbitrary decision that a prosecutor or a judge makes. I mean, the legislature has made clear what its focus is. And, you know, how that's functioning depends a lot on the resources that are there. I mean, it gets back to the questions of, do we have adequate resources for the mental health problems that exist for juveniles right now? Mm-hmm. I think the undoubted answer is probably no. There's the mental health issues with adults are, you know, part of our criminal case challenges. When we have adults that are showing mental health issues, they are required to have a psychological examination under what's called Rule 20 in the criminal system. The state court has to pay for that. And there are a lot of adults right now in our criminal court system that are there in part because of serious mental health problems. And, you know, drawing the line between behavior that is, you know, volitional and behavior that is the product of a mental illness is a real challenging issue.
And that's a high percentage, too, isn't it? I feel like I've seen numbers that say that the percentage of people in incarceration right now in America that have some level of mental illness is astronomically high.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. One other final thought here is as I was thinking about, you know, this whole public safety issue in the justice system is the question, you know, of over-policing versus under-policing. Over the past few years, been a lot of focus on concerns related to over-policing and, you know, people being subject to, frankly, behavior and traffic stops and things like that that suggests that people are, you know, being over-policed. They're being harassed for, you know, alleged minor offenses, and traffic stops turned into bigger issues. And, you know, we know some of the names of the people that have been the subject of some of those cases.
Yep.
And I read a very provocative essay in the American Journal of Law and Equality by Christopher Lewis and Adner Usmani talking about, you know, the difference of over versus under policing. And their point is that over policing isn't the problem, which is interesting.
Yeah.
Their argument is that the American criminal legal system is characterized by what they call an exceptional kind of under policing, but a heavy reliance on long prison sentences as compared to other developed nations. And their data is really interesting. And what they found is that in this country, roughly 3 people are incarcerated per police officer employed, but the rest of the so-called developed world takes a diametrically opposite balance, employing roughly 3.5 times more police officers than the number of people they incarcerate. And so the argument that these gentlemen are making is that the United States has it backwards, that justice and efficiency demand a balance between policing and incarceration more like the rest of the developed world. And it's really an interesting thought that, you know, the effects of under-policing on communities can be, you know, devastating.
Well,
and we've seen, you know, the plaintiffs in the cases that have been brought in Minneapolis related to the Minneapolis Police Department are largely from the north side of Minneapolis, representing, you know, a community that has you know, claimed in the past to be a victim of over-policing, but yet their complaint is that they are being under-policed because of the city charter mandating a certain number of officers in the city of Minneapolis. And that case obviously came to our court, and we agreed with them. And, you know, it's an interesting paradox in terms of, you know, under-policing, over-policing and, you know, large incarceration rates versus over-policing and less. I mean, it's just, it's thought-provoking in terms of what makes our system, where are the flaws in it? And this article I thought was just fascinating because it really turned on its end some of maybe the assumptions that I had about some of the causes of problems in the justice system. I mean, is the justice system inefficient? Is it unjust? I mean, those are things that have been critiques of the American justice system.
Well,
but what are the causes of this? You know, and so if we've got, you know, police that are focusing too much on petty offenses, if we've got, you know, people that are, you know, feeling that they're being, you know, the priorities aren't being sought appropriately by law enforcement. I, you know, I don't have any answers to this. And like any academic article, there are arguments for on all sides of this. But I think it's something that's worth thinking about as we talk about, you know, our law enforcement communities and about, you know, the focus of our justice system.
Well, I'm making a note to we're going to talk about this in the next 2 or 3 months because, you know, we talked earlier about sentencing guidelines,
yes,
right? And mandatory minimums. Last time I checked, and I would assume that these numbers have stayed about right, but have stayed about the same. United States of America has the largest number of citizens incarcerated per capita. And, you know, this is gets to what you're talking
That's
about.
That's what this article is focusing on, is
exactly.
Compared to, you know, Western Europe and other, you know, in terms of other countries with a justice system that, you know, focuses less on incapacitation, as they say, incarceration, and more on, you know, on you know, policing. It's interesting. Yeah, there's a lot there, Rich. There is a lot there.
Right. And,
you know, we could talk about the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. We are on the process. I'm on that entity. Its annual report is going to be submitted to the legislature in January.
Okay.
And in that document, we show the incarceration rates in the state of Minnesota over time. And after that report is published in January, I think that would be a good time to have a discussion about that and about, you know, how our incarceration rates have changed over time and, you know, where are the priorities right now.
How does our incarceration rate compare to other states in the country?
My understanding, Rich, and this is in the document, is that we actually have one of the lower rates of incarceration. I think we're in the lowest 5, if I recall correctly, in terms of rates of incarceration in the country.
Okay.
But, you know, the incarceration for what purpose is an important aspect of things. I mean, what is the purpose of it? I mean, obviously, deterrence is part of it. Justice is part of it. There's a lot of varying views on these things.
Yeah.
And I can just tell you that the Guidelines Commission is hearing from both sides of those discussions.
Yeah.
And we just had a public hearing last week, as a matter of fact, and on some issues related to sentencing guidelines. And, you know, you hear from all ends of the political spectrum on that.
Right. I have had a couple of long conversations with former Rice County Sheriff Troy Dunn on his ideas of incarceration. Rice County is building a new jail right now, and he was a strong advocate to get that jail built because of kind of what you're talking about, how what really is the point of incarceration? I mean, are we just trying to punish people and lock them away, or are we trying to help people turn their lives around? And this new facility that Rice County is building is going to be more geared toward that, far more easily than the facility that we have in the county right now. that's going to be a fun conversation, or a very interesting conversation.
Yeah, so we'll have some things to talk about in the new year, Rich.
Yeah.
Wish you well here at KYMN, and we thanks for continuing to have interest in legal subjects.
Well, you know, you approached us earlier in 2022 about this show, and I just on behalf of the radio station and just from me, thank you for coming to the station this year. Thank you for bestowing this gift of a show upon us. And we really appreciate the time you give us and our listeners every month.
Well, I appreciate it a lot, Rich. I hope that what we talk about has some relevance to the interests and in the lives of our listeners. And I just feel the third branch sometimes is the least understood branch. And my purpose here is to try to help, you know, pull the veil back a little bit to show people and talk about what happens and why it happens. And, you know, I obviously am coming at this from a bit of a cheerleader standpoint, being on, you know, the Supreme Court, we're overseeing, you know, the rest of the judicial system, but it's just imperative that citizens understand to a large degree what happens in the court system and why. And that doesn't mean that you have to be a lawyer, but, you know, you should have an understanding of things when you read about them and hear about them in terms of what's happening.
Well, if I may say so, I don't mind at all having a member of the Supreme Court as a cheerleader for the judicial system. So that actually reinforces my faith in things.
We have a great judicial system. I'm just going to say it. I think our judicial system is the envy of many states. We have weathered the pandemic storm pretty darn well, frankly, largely due to the leadership of our Chief Justice, Lori Gilday, who deserves a ton of credit for steering the ship through some really turbulent and uncharted waters.
Yes.
You know, we got constitutional rights that had to be met, people in jail that had the right to have their trials. And it was rocky at times, but I think we're coming out on the other side of it in pretty darn good shape. We've got work to do. There are backlogs. There are concerns about funding. But relatively speaking, I think we're in pretty good shape.
Yeah, well, that's good news. Glad to hear you say that. Well, have yourself a fine holiday, Gordon, and to you and your family. I hope you get to spend a little time with your family.
Yeah, we'll have all three of our children back over the holiday, and
fantastic.
One's finishing up across town here currently. Yeah. We're keeping our fingers crossed that goes okay, and we got some transitions in our family, but we're looking forward to it, Rick. You have a great holiday too, everybody down here at KYMN the same.
Thank you, sir. And we will be back. This Legal Talk comes around the third Monday of every month. So we will be back in January.
Yes.
Thank you, Gordon. This has been Legal Talk with Minnesota Supreme Court Associate Justice Gordon Moore. If you have questions for Justice Moore or would like to suggest a topic for future conversations, email us at contact@kymnradio.net.
95.1. The One.